What the military may have seen was Mr. Ahmadi and a colleague loading canisters of water into the trunk of his car to bring home to his family. While the US military said the drone strike might have killed 3 Afghan civilians, New York Times reporting shows that it killed 10, including 7 Afghan children, in a dense residential block. Mr. Ahmadi, a 43-year-old, had worked since 2006 as an electrical engineer for Nutrition and Education International, a California-based aid group. The morning of the strike, Mr. Ahmadi's boss called from the office at around 8:45 a.m. and asked him to pick up his laptop. I asked him if he was still at home, and he said yes. The country director said in an interview at Nutrition and Education International's office in Kabul, Afghanistan. Like the rest of Mr. Ahmadi's colleagues, he spoke of condition of anonymity because of his association with an American company in Afghanistan. According to his relatives, that morning, Mr. Ahmadi left for work around 9 a.m. in a white 1996 Corolla that belonged to Nutrition and Education International, departing from his house where he lived with his 3 brothers and their families, a few kilometers west of Kabul airport. U.S. officials told the New York Times that it was around this time that their target, a white sedan, first came under surveillance after it was spotted leaving a compound identified as an alleged ISIS safe house about 5 kilometers northwest of Kabul airport. It is unclear if officials were referring to one of the 3 stops that Mr. Ahmadi made to pick up 2 passengers and a laptop on his way to work. The latter location, the home of Nutrition and Education International's country director, was close to where a rocket attack claimed by ISIS would be launched against the airport the following morning from an improvised launcher concealed inside the trunk of a Toyota Corolla, a model similar to Mr. Ahmadi's vehicle. A New York Times reporter visited the director at his home and met with members of his family who said they had been living there for more than 40 years. "We have nothing to do with terrorism or ISIS," said the director, who also has a U.S. resettlement case. "We love America and we want to go there." Throughout the day, an MQ-9 Reaper drone continued to track Mr. Ahmadi's vehicle as it drove around Kabul, and U.S. officials claimed they intercepted communications between the sedan and the alleged ISIS safe house, instructing it to make several stops. But the people who rode with Mr. Ahmadi that day said that what the military, US military, interpreted as a series of suspicious moves was in fact simply a normal day at work. After stopping to pick up breakfast, Mr. Ahmadi and his 2 passengers arrived at Nutrition and Education International's office, where security camera footage obtained by the New York Times recorded their arrival at 9:35 a.m. Later that morning, Mr. Ahmadi drove some co-workers to a Taliban-occupied police station downtown, where they said they requested permission to distribute food to refugees in a nearby park. Mr. Ahmadi and his 3 passengers returned to the office around 2 p.m. As seen on camera footage, Mr. Ahmadi came out a half hour later with a hose that was streaming water. With the help of a security guard, he filled several empty plastic containers with water. According to his co-workers, water deliveries had stopped in his neighborhood after the collapse of the Afghan government, and Mr. Ahmadi had been bringing home water from the office. "I filled the containers myself and helped him load them into the trunk of his car," the security guard said. At 3:38 p.m., the security guard and another co-worker moved the car further into the driveway. The camera footage ends soon after, when the office shut off its generator at the end of the workday and Mr. Ahmadi and 3 passengers left for home. Around this time, US officials said that the drone had tracked Mr. Ahmadi to a compound 8 to 12 kilometers southwest of Kabul Airport, a location that matched Nutrition and Education International's office. There, they said the drone observed Mr. Ahmadi and three others loading heavy packages into the car, which they believed might contain explosives. But the passengers said that they had only two laptops with them, which they put inside the vehicle, and that the trunk of the car had no other cargo than the plastic water-filled containers that were placed there earlier. In separate interviews, all three passengers denied loading explosives into the vehicle they were about to commute home in. According to one of Mr. Ahmadi's passengers, a colleague who regularly commuted with him, the ride home was filled with their usual laughing and banter, but with one difference. Mr. Ahmadi kept the radio silent as he was afraid of getting in trouble with the Taliban. He liked cheerful music, the colleague said. That day we couldn't play any music in the car. Mr. Ahmadi dropped off his three passengers and then headed for his home near Kabul Airport. I asked him to come in for a bit, but he said he was tired, the last passenger said. Although US officials said that at that point they still knew little about Mr. Ahmadi's identity, they had become convinced that the white sedan he was driving posed an imminent threat to US troops at Kabul Airport. When Mr. Ahmadi pulled into the courtyard of his home, which officials said was different than the alleged ISIS safe house, the tactical commander made the decision to strike the vehicle, launching a Hellfire missile at around 4:50 p.m. Although the target was now inside the densely populated residential area, the drone operator quickly scanned and saw only a single adult male greeting the vehicle, and therefore assessed with reasonable certainty that no women, no children, or non-combatants would be killed, according to US officials. But according to Mr. Ahmadi's relatives, as Mr. Ahmadi pulled into his courtyard, several of his children and his brother's children came out, excited to see him, and sat in the car as he backed it inside. Mr. Ahmadi's brother, Romal, was sitting on the ground floor and his wife when he heard the sound of the gate opening and Mr. Ahmadi's car entering. His adult cousin, Nasser, had gone to fetch water for his ablutions and greeted him. The car's engine was still running when there was a sudden blast and the room was sprayed with shattered glass from the window, Romal recalled. He staggered to his feet. "Where are the children?" he asked his wife. "They're outside," she replied. Romal ran out into the courtyard. He saw that his nephew, Faisal, a 16-year-old teenager, had fallen from the exterior staircase, his torso and head grievously wounded by shrapnel. He wasn't breathing. Amid the smoke and fire, he saw another dead nephew before neighbors arrived and pulled him away, he said. Since the strike, U.S. military officials justified their actions by citing an even larger blast that took place afterwards. Because there were secondary explosions, there is reasonable conclusion to be made that there was explosives within the vehicle, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said last week. But an examination of the scene of the strike, conducted by the New York Times visual investigation team and a New York Times reporter the morning afterwards, and followed up with a second visit 4 days later, found no evidence of a second, more powerful explosion. Experts who examined photographs and videos pointed out that although there was clear evidence of a missile strike and subsequent vehicle fire, there were no collapsed or blown-out walls, no destroyed vegetation, and only one dent in the entrance gate indicating a single shockwave. It seriously questions the credibility of the intelligence or technology utilized to determine this was a legitimate target, said Chris Cobb-Smith, a British Army veteran and security consultant. While the US military has so far acknowledged only three Afghan civilian casualties, Mr. Ahmadi's relatives said that 10 members of their family, including 7 children, were killed in the US strike. Mr. Ahmadi, the three of his children, Zamir, 20 years old, Faisal, 16-year-old, and Farzad, 10 years old, Mr. Ahmadi's cousin, Nasser, 30-year-old, three of Romal's children, Arwin, 7 years old, Benjamin, 6 years old, and Hayat, 2-year-old, and two 3-year-old girls, Malikir and Somayir. Neighbors and an Afghan health official confirmed that bodies of children were removed from the site. They said the blast had shredded most of the victims. Family members questioned why Mr. Ahmadi would have a motivation to attack American troops when he had already applied for refugee settlement in the United States. His adult cousin Nasser, a former U.S. military contractor, had also applied for resettlement in the United States. He had planned to marry his fiancée Samia last Friday so that she could be included in his immigration case. "All of them were innocent," said Emal, Mr. Ahmadi's brother. "You say he was an ISIS member, but he actually worked for the Americans."
Around the world with reporters.
The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
"And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars."
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to the promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
"Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbu prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement."
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jilbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army.
Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise. With MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK, an all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active massages like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalized Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of scepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Daraa city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
فاليوم احنا نعود.
Today, Dar al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Dar al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Dar al-Balad, southern Syria.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says, financial problems.
We are Sabreen Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are, before we received oil from the WHO, during 2021, the amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth. The amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many child and women, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only 3 oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the years-long Saudi war and the blockade. Yemenis also blame the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continuous Saudi violations of their rights. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
French President Macron announced recently that the Operation Barkhane in the Sahel region, especially in Mali, will be reshaped before the end of the year. Barkhane is a French military operation that started in 2014 in 5 Sahel countries, Mauritania, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad and Mali, officially to fight against Al-Qaeda and Daesh-affiliated groups. In the beginning, French officials considered it as a success, but 7 years later, they admit that they have failed. Macron blames the Sahel states for the failure.
We cannot secure regions sliding back into lawlessness because the states decide not to take their responsibilities. That's impossible.
But are the Sahel states the only ones to blame? Is the stalemate in Mali not the result of the failure of French neocolonial policy in the region? Fact is that years after the French military intervention began, Mali is today divided in two, with the Malian state very little present in the north, where radical rebel groups control large parts of the country. So why did France intervene?
Ce qui a décidé la France.
France has decided to intervene in the Sahel and in Mali to preserve its influence in the region. The French diplomacy was convinced that the status of France in the UN Security Council depended from the support of the Sahel countries. It guaranteed France of almost 30 extra votes in the UN General Assembly in support of its diplomacy.
But now France is getting bogged down in Mali, titles the monthly newspaper Le Monde Diplomatique. That's why France reshapes its military presence. 2,500 soldiers instead of 5,000. The new operation is called Takuba. Eventually, other European countries may join the French, but they are reluctant. Nobody wants to be humiliated as the USA have recently been in Afghanistan. The French neocolonial policy in the region is not anymore what it was. The central command of the Takuba Task Force will now be in Niger instead of Mali. That's not a coincidence. Niger has important uranium mines essential to feed the nuclear power plants in France. The Barkhane operation in Mali is coming to its end, but in fact it will continue under another name and by other means with the same hidden goal, to protect the economic interests of France in the region. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware, among them those who profited immensely from the so-called war on terror. The UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support. The defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country.
Campaigners also point out that several countries specifically invited here, such as the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, are on the UK government's human rights watch list.
The fact that we're hosting such hideous weaponry and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen.
Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia, worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral.
The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
Researchers say coronavirus is more contagious and more lethal than influenza, and we lack the same global protection mechanism. We have prepared for you an article written by Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Why Living with COVID Would Not Be the Same as Flu. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. England prepares to ease coronavirus restrictions further, the messaging from ministers has changed. They said, it seems we have reached a tipping point in the pandemic where rules will be replaced by personal decisions. The mantra now is about living with coronavirus, much as we do with seasonal flu. The pandemic has invited countless comparisons between coronavirus and influenza, and the diseases do have some features in common. Both are contagious, potentially lethal respiratory viruses. They can spread through aerosols, droplets, and contaminated surfaces. And they share some of the same symptoms in the form of fever, cough, headaches, and fatigue. In the winter ahead, one challenge the NHS staff face is separating the COVID patients from the flu cases. But there are striking differences between coronavirus and flu as well, and these matter very much for public health. Coronavirus spreads faster than influenza and can cause far more serious illness. The symptoms of coronavirus can take longer to show, and people tend to be contagious for longer, making them more prone to passing it on. Seasonal influenza has been around long enough that previous infection and protection from vaccines bear down on cases and deaths. Analysis of previous influenza outbreaks suggests that there are value for seasonal flu. The number of people an infected person passes the virus onto averages about 1.28. This means a group of four people with flu might pass the virus onto five more people. Coronavirus spreads more easily than that. For the Delta variant now surging around the world, R is estimated at about 7. So in the absence of vaccines and other interventions, a single case would infect an average of 7 others. As vaccination programs push on and the virus continues to spread, immunity to coronavirus will drive R down. But how low is a moot point. Coronavirus is more lethal than influenza, largely because vulnerability to the disease rockets in older people. Seasonal influenza killed an estimated 44,505 people in England during the three combined flu seasons from 2015-2016 to 2018-2019. That number died from COVID in England in the first 9 weeks of 2021. A major difference is that the flu figure takes into account the protection of influenza vaccines, where 50% effectiveness is considered good. Coronavirus vaccines should have a greater proportional impact on COVID deaths. So far, the most common COVID vaccines used in the United Kingdom, the Oxford AstraZeneca and the Pfizer-BioNTech shots, reduce the risk of hospitalization from COVID by more than 90%. As a result, the vaccination program has driven COVID deaths down substantially to fewer than 20 a day in the past week. But the vaccines do much more to prevent death than transmission of the virus. So cases of COVID are expected to rise for some time yet. The larger the epidemic grows, the more chance the virus has of finding vulnerable people who have not had their vaccine shots or are not sufficiently protected by the vaccine. While the vaccines dramatically weaken the link between cases and deaths, they are unlikely to break it entirely. The differences between coronavirus, influenza, and the vaccines that target them can easily eclipse a more fundamental issue, though. Learning to live with coronavirus as we live with flu does not mean society can take it in its stride. Every year, a comprehensive global surveillance network detects which variants of influenza are in circulation and most likely to pose a threat in the following season. That information determines which strains go into the annual flu vaccines that are then rolled out in established campaigns. Throughout the flu season, the public health authorities issue case counts and, if needed, update their advice on medical care. There is no such global system for coronavirus as yet. And despite the well-oiled machine that protects the world from flu, the death toll from the virus in a typical year is still substantial. Every winter, flu puts enormous stress on the National Health Service, the NHS, at times pushing it to breaking point. For the health service, living with coronavirus means learning to endure a double wave each winter as coronavirus and flu arrive together. Researchers are working to establish whether the flu jab and a COVID vaccine can be given at the same time as the NHS braces itself for a potential surge in cases of flu this winter. Experts say giving the two shots at the same time could save precious resources for the NHS by avoiding millions of unnecessary appointments. Adam Finn, Professor of Pediatrics at Bristol Medical School and a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said, "It isn't actually that difficult to give two injections at the same time. We do this in children all the time. But organizing totally different visits has a massive implication in terms of resources and time and so on." According to surveillance data largely encompassing England compiled by the Royal College of GPs, since the start of the pandemic, lockdowns, social distancing and mask wearing have reduced the risk of contracting not only COVID, but other respiratory bugs as well, such as the flu, cases of which were basically non-existent last winter. Assuming that many of these measures are lifted in the coming months, a resurgence of flu viruses is expected. Graham Medley, a professor at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who chairs the SAGE subgroup on pandemic modelling, said, "I think we absolutely expect that contact rates will not be as low this coming winter as they were last winter. Restrictions will not be as heavy, and as a result, there will be a flu epidemic." Graham Medley said, "And because of the fact we didn't have one last winter, that might be a bit larger, or a lot larger, and I think that's something that focus will turn to as much as COVID in the future." The Come Flu Cough study is looking at what side effects people get when they are given a recommended flu vaccine alongside either the Oxford AstraZeneca or the Pfizer BioNTech jab, as well as the immune responses when the two shots are co-administered. Professor Finn said early results on the side effects when the two jabs are given together had been shared with the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. The study's chief investigator, Dr. Rayeka Lazarus, a consultant in infectious diseases and microbiology at University Hospitals Bristol and Western NHS Foundation Trust, said, "However, the official results are expected by August or September." She said for now, the study is looking at the impact of giving the second COVID dose alongside a flu vaccine, but further research may be needed if a subsequent booster COVID shot is required. Professor Finn said there was a reasonably strong possibility that both the COVID and flu jabs could be administered in one appointment either this autumn or as part of a program to administer COVID booster shots early next year, or even both. The big question facing researchers on the Cum-Flu-Cough study is whether the side effects produced by giving both jabs together are worse than when they are given on their own. Another key question is whether the immunity provided by the two jabs changes when they are administered at the same time. Martin Hibbard, a professor of emerging infectious diseases at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said one concern is that the immune system could respond to one vaccine more than the other, adding, "So you might get a very good response to the COVID vaccine, let's say, but not a very good one to the flu jab, or the other way round. And so that could be a problem." He added, alternatively, getting the jabs at the same time might boost the immune response to both. Novavax, the COVID vaccine developer that recently published successful late-stage data on its jab, examined a study that has yet to be peer-reviewed, whether its vaccine could be given in tandem with an influenza vaccine. Data showed that co-administered jabs resulted in no change to influenza vaccine immune response, while a minor reduction in antibody responses from 89.8% to 87.5% was found for the COVID vaccine. Novavax and Moderna are also in the early stages of developing a combined COVID and flu vaccine.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Nigeria's president recently signed into law an oil overhaul bill that has been in the pipeline for almost two decades. Now, this law is seen as historic for Africa's top oil producer, which has seen this natural resource exploited by foreign companies without any benefit to the local communities. Now, the bill was approved by the Senate and House of Representatives. Nigeria's Senate President says communities hosting oil and gas production are the winners.
The host communities are winners as well. It may not be necessarily exactly what some of them had hoped, but, you know, from zero to over $500 million, I think it's a big jump. And with the time, such issues could be further addressed. But I want to also caution that it's not the $500 million that is small, but how we are able to prudently and transparently deploy these $500 million in the host communities.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenya. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the new Petroleum Industry Act in Nigeria and asking, will the local communities benefit from this long-delayed oil and gas law? In the second part of our program, we shall see how production of clothing, including for high street brands in Europe and the United States, is killing Africa's rivers through polluting discharges of untreated industrial wastewater. Join us till the end of our show as our guests give us an incisive analysis on these two subjects.
Nigeria's new oil law. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari recently signed the country's much-anticipated petroleum industry bill following nearly two decades of attempts and revisions. The new law is expected to overhaul the oil and gas industry in Africa's biggest crude producer. President Buhari said the new oil industry law marks the end of decades of uncertainty and underinvestment in the petroleum industry. He called for the implementation to be completed within 12 months.
I have approved an implementation framework commencing immediately to ensure the industry envisaged in the new law begins to take shape. The implementation process, to be headed by the Honorable Minister of State, Petroleum Resources, is hereby tasked with the completion of the implementation of this act within 12 months. I am therefore directing all relevant ministries, departments, and agencies of government to fully cooperate in ensuring the successful and timely implementation.
Celebrations over the new oil industry law in Nigeria were dimmed by controversy over the allocation of 3% revenue to host communities in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. Now, some community leaders in the region have rejected the bill, saying they will continue agitating for their rights.
With what they have done, they have not stopped agitation. They have not helped the argument. They've not resolved any conflict. They have created more conflict because the agitation pressure will only be higher.
Now, for more on the new oil industry law in Nigeria, we have contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, can you first tell us what impact will the Petroleum Industry Act have on this critical sector in Nigeria?
So the Petroleum Industry Bill has been in the making for over a decade, and a lot of people are relieved that it has come to be. But it may be a good sign for some investors, but to those of us concerned about the environment, it's not good news at all.
Thank you for that, Mr. Basse.
The governors of the 36 states of the country, under the auspices of the Nigeria Governors Forum, have described the Petroleum Industry Act as a recipe for disaster. The chairman of the forum, Dr. Kayode Fayemi, has expressed concern over 30% allocation for frontier exploration and the 3% for the host communities.
Our primary concern to me and the people I speak for is the entire forum of Nigerian governors. And this is a matter that the entire forum has discussed extensively, and we have come to certain conclusions about what is called frontier funds, whether it is 3% or not. For us, our concern there is that whatever you are taking into these places is a depletion from the Federation account. That money will not go to the Federation account. It would be spread across the few areas that you described as frontier basins rather than to the entire Federation.
Nigerian governors have particularly rejected the amount to be paid to host communities where oil companies are operating. Can you elaborate on that?
Three major issues include the fact that the provisions made in the bill, in the law for host investment in host communities is very disturbing. The communities ask for 10%. While the Senate recommended 3%, the House of Representatives recommended 5%. Eventually, the bill that was sent to the President asked for 10% investment funding for communities where the oil activities are taking place. Now, the major contention on that issue is not necessarily the how small the amount is, but the fact that oil companies they are the ones to determine who is a host community. Who is a community that has oil facilities, and this excludes communities that just have only the pollution, because the entire region is polluted. Moreover, the oil companies have the upper hand in determining who decides what the funding is used for. And we think this is very colonial and unacceptable.
Decades of oil spills and gas flaring have transformed the Niger Delta in Nigeria into one of the most polluted places on the planet. A Nigerian boy narrates how his younger brother died after falling into a river contaminated with oil that leaked from a pipeline owned by Shell, Europe's biggest oil and gas company.
My brother fell into the oil one morning. He was 6 years old. I saw oil all over his body. Oil came out from his nose, his mouth, his ears. He swallowed the oil a lot.
went to the hospital, they could not help him. When we get home, we tried to feed him, but we couldn't help him anymore. He was already dead.
Now, Mr. Basse, you earlier talked about environmental concerns. Now, do we have provisions in the new law that will ensure multinationals adhere to local laws, especially relating to the environment, and compensation to local communities that have suffered over the years?
Well, the new law is blind to the environment. It's not really concerned about the environment. It's all about the financial management of oil revenue. It's about the investment in the sector. It's about attracting investment. And the only thing that suggests that something may go to the communities is a 3% allocation, 3% of funds from the sector that should go towards the communities. And now this funding is like giving with one hand and taking the same fund from with the other hand, because another aspect of the law says that if there's an infringement, if there's maybe an accident along the pipeline, there's oil spill and so on and so forth, and this is attributed to third-party interference, then it means that the communities involved will have to pay for the repair of that situation. What this means is that the oil companies, who always attribute any kind of environmental misbehavior to third-party interference, trying to escape their responsibility, would continue to do so, and then the 3% allocation for communities will end up going back to the pockets of oil companies. So we're seeing this as absolutely unhealthy and insensitive.
Well, Nigeria's Dangote oil refinery is expected to buy at least 300,000 barrels per day of the country's crude production. Now, this comes after the government granted approval for a 20% equity purchase in the project promoted by Africa's richest man. Now, the 650,000 barrel per day refinery owned by billionaire Aliko Dangote is under construction in Lagos. The refinery plans to start operations by January. Now, Mr. Basse, there will be increased oil refining in Nigeria following the approval of the new oil law. Now, do you see these impacting negatively on the environment?
Above all, what this means to us, why we're worried about this, is not about the big private refinery impacting the country negatively, but the fact that you have that big refinery right there at the shoreline of Lagos, you're going to have more pollution, you're going to have destruction of fisheries, you're going to impoverish the people, you're going to poison the people with all the toxic elements coming from the refinery, and then moreover, the country is going to say, well, we have all this oil, why should we move to renewable energy?
Contrary to expectations that the signing of the Petroleum Industry Act would automatically lead to the removal of fuel subsidy, the federal government of Nigeria says the subsidy will remain until a feasible framework is developed.
The PIB has actually deregulated the sector, but that doesn't mean that there will be an immediate implementation of that price hike, of that of the deregulation. What the PIB provides is that products will be sold at market dictated prices. So it will not be shouldered by, it will be shouldered by all of us. This is the only fund that is targeted at the host communities in this country. Because all other such funds were not really targeted at the host community. You have the 13% derivation, which was also instituted to douse this problem. And many times, this 13% is not targeted at the host communities. So the 13% may be spent somewhere, and the problem is happening somewhere else.
Of course, most Nigerians are opposed to removal of the fuel subsidy, saying it will push up inflation.